little late. My name is Monsignor Riley. I come from a strange place called Brooklyn in New York. You might recognize my little accent sometimes. It's a little bit different. I've come in order to go fishing with you tomorrow. I learned this from my master. He took 12 men and he said, I'm going to teach you how to fish. And they said, you're kidding me, you're a carpenter. And we are the experts in fishing. He said, that's okay. Take your little boats and go off the shore a little bit. They said, we were all night fishing and we got nothing. He said, take it and throw. Do I tell you? Of course, the boats were sinking with the amount of fish that they caught. And when they finished that, they were ready to listen to him. And little did he know that he was going to make the fishes of souls. And then that's basically when I come. I come not to give you a talk. Anybody can do that. I come to teach you how to fish for souls and how to save life. And then I leave, and I leave behind my fishing reel, my rod, my bait, and everything else, and you go fishing. And I come back later and found out you're catching bigger fish than me. This happens all over the world, all over the world. That's amazing. That's basically, so we're going to go fishing together tomorrow, okay? But I want you to know how to fish and why we're going, and the attitude of mind and heart that you must have in order to be successful. The helper's approach is used across the United States. We've had more than 100 bishops and 7 cardinals alone in the United States leading helper's prayer vigils. But it's being used all over the world. It's being used all over the world. And with success. I can share with you the largest portion of New York City, one of the oldest in the country, started in 1971. At this particular abortion mill, they did. More babies died there than in Dachau. More than 250,000 babies died there. And suddenly, after everything, it stopped. And next Saturday, we're having a mass for Thanksgiving. And after the mass, we're going down to what was the abortion center. It's now a place of healing. It's going to be open house. All the abortionists are gone, and we're going to bless the place. Some abortion mills have one operating room in it. This place had 4 state-of-the-art operating rooms in it. It was the largest. And I say, in that area alone, more than 250,000 babies have died there. They killed the babies up to the 7th month. And then suddenly it's all over. But it's not closed. It's reopening as a place of only of healing, right? With the same owners. Aha, that's the complete victory. You see, that's what we're about. You see, that's what we're about. And so that's what your goal is. See, your goal is not to save babies. Oh, we want to save the unborn children. Definitely we do. That's not our goal. That cannot be our primary goal. The primary goal is to save souls. I often say to people, you know, the culture of death is not the baby's dying. You say, what? Well, no, actually, the culture, they are receiving the effects of the culture of death. Right? But the baby's dying is they're dying because others are killing them, but they're not part of the culture of death. The culture of death are the people killing the babies. The people who work in these places, who bring others there, the people doing this, these are the ones who are the culture of death. The children, the unborn children, are one of the people primarily, they experience the effects of the culture of death by the loss of their physical lives, but they never did anything wrong in their little lives. Nothing. Innocent, the holy innocence. Right? And there's no impediment in their souls to receive the fullness of life. What stops us from receiving the fullness of life, because life is a gift. We forget that, don't we? Physical life, spiritual life, it's a gift from God. And as long as you don't put something in the way, you can accept the gift, you can receive it with gratitude. Not in karata, but with gratitude. And the unborn children, they never did any moral evil in their life. And so to me it's impossible that they don't receive the further gift of eternal life. Why would they not? God came to give it. We know that most people receive this greater gift of life not through the sacrament of baptism and water. That's the exception, isn't it? You say that? No, that's the rule. Actually, it's not. The normal way of receiving this newness of life is through the word spoken and water baptism. But the majority of the people in the world are not Catholics. And their souls are being saved. But it's being saved because of Jesus Christ, the blood of Christ. So the extraordinary way that God gives the effects of his life-saving death is not told to us immediately. We know they receive it by baptism of desire, baptism of blood, and they receive it. And so these unborn children in our own country alone, 53 million, there's no way they're outside the realm of salvation. They've done nothing wrong in their life. There's no impediment to receiving life. Life is a gift, human and divine life. It's both a gift, and they don't put any obstacle in the way. See, so the abortionist, he can just touch the physical body of the child. He can't touch their souls. It's like being hit with a Mack truck, okay? But their souls go to God. Their souls go to God. And they never stop loving God, and they are with God. So we do go that their physical bodies may be saved. We want that desperately. We want that tomorrow when we pray. But a greater evil here is the moral evil. And the people who need our presence tomorrow more than the unborn children are the owners of the clinic. The ones who need our presence more than the unborn children are the ones who are bringing the children there, the ones having the abortion, the abortionist. They're the ones whose souls have to be saved. See, we have to have the mentality. When you go to an abortion clinic, I say you're going to a modern-day Golgotha. You're going to Calvary. And you have to observe, why are you there? Why did Jesus go to Calvary? How were people present there at Calvary? St. Peter didn't understand it. That's before he became a saint. He told Jesus, it's dangerous, they're going to kill you. You don't go there, you're crazy. And our Lord had to say to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You don't know what you're talking about. I am going there to die for the person who's going to kill me. You're what? Yeah. That's why I'm going there, Peter. I give you a final commandment, said Jesus. This really separates Christians from non-Christians. This really makes a Catholic and a non-Catholic. What's my final commandment that I give to you? It's a tough one. I want you to love your enemies. If you do not love your enemies, there'll be no peace on earth. I don't care how many weapons we build. I don't care how many agreements, concords we bring. You cannot have peace on earth unless there are people willing to forgive their enemies. It's impossible. But that type of love is impossible, isn't it? It isn't, you know. I mean, it's tough enough to love your friends, never mind your enemies. You know, it reminds me of the Greek tragedy. You know, we learn a lot from the ancient past. There was a fellow who was a professor at Chicago University. He wrote a book, his name was Alan Bloom. He wrote the book, and it was published about 1988, called The Closing of the American Mind, or How Our Higher Universities Have Totally Failed Our Students. If you read that book, it's very interesting. And they have, of course they have. The students go to college and they come out very really knowledgeable in what we call productive knowledge. Oh, they can, they have their skill to make money. Their skill to make all types of things. But they do not get wisdom. They do not get directive knowledge. They do not know, see, they know how to make a living, but they don't know how to live. Well, why do we send them to college? What's the university about? Well, the university was, for centuries, the place where you ask the first primary question, who am I? What's the purpose of my life? What is life about? Not how to make a living. That's secondary. As a matter of fact, you don't teach people how to do things until you're sure they're good people. They're dangerous otherwise. They're dangerous. The ancients knew that. See, in the universities, you first had to have liberal education before you'd be taught how to make a living, productive knowledge. You didn't pick your major, so to speak, until you got to your third or fourth year. And the first 2 years was to teach you how to live and to open up to you that humans didn't start yesterday. And that the ages past had an awful lot to tell us. Wisdom is found in the Greek culture, in the Latin culture, in the Christian culture, in the Middle Ages. There's a tremendous amount of wisdom. And our young people are not exposed to that at all. They're not exposed to the Bible. They are given an absolutely superficial, almost meaningless, almost perverted education. And so they come out and, what do you want me to do? Save your baby or kill it? What do you want me to do? Light up the city with atomic energy and blow it up? What do you want me to do? Whatever you want. But it's not what I want. What's your values? Aren't there certain things that you won't do? Don't you come to the table with a certain understanding of what's right and what's wrong? Don't you understand who you are? No, we've lost it. We've lost it. And they don't look upon humans as precious to God. They look upon humans as something special and sacred. It's interesting. There was a play by, you know, the Greek writer called Euripides, or 500 years before Jesus. There was a group of men, Aristophanes and Sophocles and Euripides. And these are men, Aeschylus, brilliant men, who wrote plays. Through their plays, they taught. And Euripides at that time, he wanted to upgrade the place of women in society. It's a new cause. If you look at his plays, every one of his plays has a woman's name. And it was always with the twist of elevating the woman. If you read Euripides' Medea and the Medea from the Jason and the Argonauts, Medea, by Euripides, you get a lot of sympathy for her. That Jason drove her nuts. And she became hysterical because of what he did. But there's a play I'd like to just tonight, just to mention to you, it's called Alcestes. Because it has meaning for us. This is what you do. You expose the young people to what has preceded us, and you learn from it. Life did not start, human race did not start yesterday. And those who lived before us, they have a great amount of wisdom to tell us. So in the play Alcestes, Alcestes is King Admetus' wife. He's the king of Thessaly. And in the story, basically it's this, Apollo falls out of favor with the king of the gods, and he's sent down to earth as a punishment. And he comes down to earth, what a punishment. He comes down to earth, and he's looking for a place to stay, some hospitality. And the king of Thessaly, Admetus, says, come to my house. And he does. And he puts in his time, and finally his sentence is finished, and he's going back to Mount Olympus, going back to the gods. And he wants to give some type of gratitude, thank you to the king. And just before that, the king learns that he's going to die an early death. Surprise, that happens. Huh? You get a report suddenly, not me. It's always someone else, but not me. No, it's you. And he finds out that, and Apollo finds this out, and he knows it. And so he intercedes with the fates. They would change the fates of this man. And the answer comes back, we will change the fates if the king can find someone in his kingdom who will die in his place. Oh, and so he tells, Apollo tells Admetus, the king, he said, look, I've got this gift to you. Your life is going to be spared. but on the condition you find someone in the kingdom who will die in your place. So Amina starts to go around the kingdom saying, I've got to speak to you for a minute. Yeah, what do you want to say? Would you die in my place? And the first, are you out of your mind? I'll give you taxes. I'll give you a lot of things. I'm not going to die in your place. He's going all through the kingdom. And he couldn't find anybody that would die in his place. And so finally he went to his mom and dad. And he asked his mom and dad, would you die in my place? And he looked at them and said, what kind of a son have we raised? Are you kidding us? Life is precious. You only have one life. Each one should carry their own cross. Don't you know that? This is the parents saying to Amida's their son. Carry your own cross. What do you want us? No, we want to live as much as you. Why should we die in your place? So his own parents said, what kind of a son have we raised? How selfish could you be? And so finally, he's almost about to give up when his wife, Alcestis, she says, I will die in your place. And he said, oh my God, how great thou art, how blessed I am, you see? And she will die in my place. And he tells Apollo, I found the person, my wife, she's going to do it. Beautiful woman. And so the play opens up basically at this point, and she is now beginning to die. And everybody in the kingdom is saying, what kind of a king do we have that he's allowing his wife to die in his place? What kind of a creep is this? And his reputation, no one respected him because he wasn't willing to carry his own cross. And as his wife got sicker and sicker, all sympathy went for her, and animosity turned on the king. How could he possibly do this to such a beautiful woman? Are you crazy? And it got to a point where he realized, the one person who loves me the most, I'm going to lose. And everybody else hates me. And I'll be in that situation. Life is not worth living. And so he finally asked the Apollo to change it, change it, change it. Don't spare her, spare her, spare her. And the ending is, he does. Now, I mention that because that's our society. That's our society today. We don't want to carry our own cross. We want to put on someone else. And who is the one that you find that will die in your place? Who? The unborn child. The unborn child. But it's not even asked for consent. And it's not even a life for a life. It's a life for convenience. It's a life for embarrassment. It's a life for a thousand reasons. It's not a life for a life. Rare is that case where the abortion takes place because someone's dying. It's everything else. What kind of a people always? What kind of a king do we have? That could be so selfish and have his wife die in his place? Huh? This is insane. And yet we accept the same. Everybody placing on the little unborn child death sentence. And many, many times, 90%+ times, it's not a life for a life. It's a life for the sake of convenience, a life I want to go to school, it's a life I don't want to be embarrassed, it's a life that this is not my husband's child. There's a thousand reasons, but the child dies. And what is the result? Well, it's similar, you know, it's similar to the king. The mother begins to say, my God, I know because I deal with it all the time. I deal with it all the time. See, because when I'm outside the abortion clinics each day, counseling on the streets, I speak to the woman before the abortions and after the abortions. I do. And before the abortions, the great lie is this. If you have an abortion, it will bring back yesterday and you get on with your life again. It's that simple. Abortion resolves all problems. I don't know if you realize this, but In the Supreme Court decision of Casey versus Planned Parenthood, 1992, everybody thinks that the basis for abortion and allowing it in the United States is Roe v. Wade. It's not. It is not. Roe v. Wade, just written by Justice Blackmun, said that since people differ about when life begins, we're not going to impose one opinion over the other. So we're not going to outlaw abortion. But if a time came, he said, that it was clear that life begins when it begins at the beginning, then this judicial decision would have no value whatsoever. It would not hold. I don't know if you know that. Yeah, that's what it says. And by 1992, we were going life in the laboratories, were we not? We knew when life begins. And so at that time, the governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Casey, he said, since the unborn child is a child and is a human being, and we all know it now, the state has responsibility to protect that child. And so the Supreme Court decision went forward, and the Supreme Court made this judgment. Yes, the unborn is a child. It is a human being. I think you realize that. Yes, that's the court. And because it is a human being, Governor Casey in the state of Pennsylvania can put restrictions on the mother. However, we found a new basis for abortion. See, there's two types of judges. What we call strict constructionist judges and what we call activist judges. Now, a strict constructionist judge says this: what does the Constitution say? Is this law in conformity with the Constitution or not? If it is, it's constitutional. If it's not, it's unconstitutional. I can't help you. You want this particular change in your society? Fine. Go back to those who make the changes, the legislative body. Ask them to change the law. If you can get two-thirds of Congress and three-quarters of the state to agree, you put an amendment to your Constitution, that there it is, then we say it's constitutional. But it's not up to us as judges to change the Constitution and change the law. We are not activist judges. We're strict constructionists. Rather simple, huh? And then there are those who are the activist judges. And the activist judge says this: what do you want? This is a living, breathing constitution. Not something dead. We'll make it breathe. So I want a right to an abortion. Well, we gave you that right. Yeah, I know, but that was on the basis of when does life begin. Now we know that the unborn child's alive. We still want to do it. You got to find us a new basis for it. Just give us a few moments. We'll find it. So in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, suddenly they found the 14th Amendment, the phrase liberty, and they said the liberty of the mother is an absolute value, whereas the right to life of the child is relative. So that because the child is a child, the state of Pennsylvania can require the mother that she be informed, that she wait, that she do this, she do that. But ultimately, the state of Pennsylvania cannot stop the abortion because the mother's right under liberty is absolute, even more absolute than the unborn child's right to life. Now, it's interesting because, you know, the 14th, the 15th Amendments were added to our Constitution after the Civil War. And it was to give liberty to the black man. Interesting. And that now is used to kill black babies across America at a rate unbelievable. Beyond a genocide. Beyond a genocide. We're moving towards 18 million unborn black babies killed in the name of freedom. Using the amendment that was supposed to give the black person freedom after the Civil War. The irony of ironies. The latest statistics in New York City from the Vital Health Department. In New York City, of every 100 black babies, 60 are aborted. In Brooklyn, where I come from, every 100 black babies, 70 are aborted. How in God's name do you understand? That's beyond a genocide. 70 out of 100 in the name of freedom, of an amendment that was passed to protect and give freedom to the black people. That's demonic. That's demonic, see? So what happened in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, suddenly they told every state, you cannot restrict abortions because of the 14th Amendment and on the basis of activist judges. And so you have judges legislating from the bench. We have judicial tyranny in our country. Do you understand that? What we're dealing with in this vote coming up is not the economy. Trust me. It's not Operation Wall Street that we have. The 100%, the 99% versus the 1%. That's nonsense. Nonsense. You know what injustice is? It's the born versus the unborn. Occupy and Margaret Sanger Square in New York is what we do. If you do not have life, what's the meaning of talking about sharing in the wealth of the 1%? When you're killing all of our brothers and sisters, and you know and I know, what's wealth? Most people who are wealthy, when they find Jesus, they give it away. So the purpose of life is not to become a millionaire or a billionaire. St. Francis of Assisi, he inherited wealth, threw it all away, because he found the riches of Christ, reality of it. And so what happens is the, what do you give to your children? The inheritance, the richest inheritance you give to your children, you give to them before you die, or they never get it. And they're the real rich ones. What's the riches you give to your children? It's rather simple. You give them, first of all, life. That's first. And then you give to them how to live life, wisdom. They see your example. They listen to your words, the customs. And the last thing you give to them is love. If they can say, I have received from my parents life, how to live life, and I was loved by them, they are the richest of the rich. What in the name of God is giving a child $1 million and they don't know what to do and how to live, and they never were loved? It's meaningless. It's meaningless. Right? And so we have so out of whack. Everybody's screaming, oh, you got to have the 99% equal to the 1%. That's all nonsense. That's not the great injustice. The great injustice is not giving the children life, not giving them wisdom and love. The great injustice is destroying the place where God intends life to be conceived, namely in marriage itself. You understand that's under attack? God made us male and female. God instituted marriage, traditional marriage. That's the place God intends life to be conceived, out of an act of love in the context of family and accepted unconditionally. What happens now? Life is conceived in a petri dish, in a laboratory. And you do not continue to exist if you fail the test. Not a single child is placed in the womb of a mother if the child fails the pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test. What happens to that child? It's destroyed. No exceptions. It is destroyed. So the reality is that what God doesn't intend human life to be conceived on a petri dish in a laboratory outside the context of human love. See, the purpose of human sexuality is simple. Boy meets girl. They become good friends. They begin to share with each other and they realize their values are similar. Their religious beliefs are similar. Their outlook on life is similar. And they really find they become one in heart and mind. And then they find there's a physical attraction to each other. They really like each other. And they want to give themselves totally to each other. Totally. Including their life-giving powers, the gift of fertility. And the only way they can do that is through the sexual act. But that means I give myself to you totally. And out of that act of total love, God willing, something greater comes. Comes a person, a human being, in which God, together with you, He, when you came into existence, never forget this, the whole world was changed. It'll never be the same again. Because when you came into existence, God created your soul. You're not an animal. You're not a spirit. You're not an angel. You're a body and soul. And God called your mother and your father. Vocatio, to call. The vocation of marriage. He called your mom and dad to cooperate with God in bringing into existence a human person out of their act of love. In which God created your soul and mom and dad worked with God for your body. And so the unitive aspect, and we do not use the word reproductive rights. You're walking right into their traps. There's no such thing as reproducing a human being. Impossible. Every human being is unique on the face of the earth because you have a spiritual soul made in the image of God. There never was a person like you, never will be again. You know, it's interesting. Now, in 2001, they broke the genetic norm, the norm genetic code, remember that? And they found out that at the original cell, you know, every cell in your body has 46 chromosomes. Every cell in my body has 46 chromosomes. Save one. In the woman, the ovum has 23. In the man, the sperm, 23. All the rest of the cells are 46. And when, out of this act of love, a man gives himself to the woman to the man, and they give themselves totally to each other, and the ovum and the sperm fuse, and now you have 23 and 23, which is 46. But totally different from mom and dad and all the people in the rest of the world. That's no accident. That's by God's design. He made us male and female and coming together. And at that moment, God made your spiritual soul. See, man and woman are called by God, vocatio. Marriage is a divine vocation created by God. Called by God to cooperate with God in bringing into existence a human being that's to be forever. And so we say that ask the two purposes of marriage that must not be separated is the unitive aspect, I love you and you love me. And the procreative aspect. See, when Almighty God made the world from nothing, we call creation. When he asked man and a woman to cooperate with him, he called procreation. Rather simple. So the double purpose of marriage is procreation and unitive. Love and life. And what God has joined together, man must not separate. But we have. We have. And what we've done is we've taken this act of I love you and you love me, and we're taking out of it the purpose, life itself, and God's action. See, the eye is for seeing, the ear is for hearing, it's clear. If your eye begins to lose its ability to see, you get eyeglasses. The ear, you lose its ability to hear, you get a hearing aid. But if you put a pencil in your ear or your eye, you say you're crazy. It's against seeing. It's against hearing. Contra. Now, it couldn't be any clearer that we're going to stop conception. Contraception. It's irrational. We make the purpose of sex now not I love you and you love me, open to life and to God. We make it pure pleasure. And we now destroy God's creation. And when you did that, you no longer could argue against homosexuality. Impossible. On what grounds? If my act is sterile, so is theirs. So what? We love each other. And once you separate the act of love and sexuality from life with God, there's no way technology helps you to do that, that you can now say to technology, you cannot now have life in the laboratories without love, human love. Oh yes, that's what it is. Now we have reproductive humans in laboratories in which we eliminate all of God's mistakes. We don't have haphazard abortions. You say, wait a second, you can't have human life without God, without love? A child should not have to pass a test to continue to exist. When a child is conceived in the context of family, it's accepted unconditionally. Not now. All Down syndrome children are killed. They don't pass the test. Right now in America, 90 out of every 100 Down syndrome children are now killed. Do you see how many Down syndrome children you see running around recently? You don't, do you? In Europe, 95 out of 100 are now killed. But that's only the beginning. It's only the beginning. Grandma will be killed too. In Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision of January 22nd, 1973, it was not the beginning of taking away the protection of life to the unborn child. It was not the beginning of the culture of death. No, sir. It was the end of the culture of life. It was the culmination of the culture of death. Because in this country, in our country, our founding fathers believed that the state did not give you the right to life, not even your parents. God gave you the right to life. No one else. And if a state did not respect that, it no longer had any authority over you. We declare independence. Your right to life is absolute. No matter what your conditions are, no matter what the quality of your life is, people differ in qualities of life, no questions about that. But no matter what the quality of your life, everyone has basic right to be fed, to be clothed, to be taken care of. We don't have a basic right to own a Mercedes-Benz. Are you kidding me? But no matter what the quality of your life, no one has the right to take your life. That's gone, you know. The fifth commandment of God is gone, you know. The fifth commandment of God is this: thou shalt never kill an innocent human being. What's the new fifth commandment of God? The new fifth commandment of God is simply this: thou shalt never kill an innocent human being unless the quality of their life is not acceptable to you. Where did that start? With Roe v. Wade. In Roe v. Wade, if you read this, the decision itself, it says, since the unborn children are not yet capable of meaningful existence, you hear that? Meaningful existence, that's quality of life language. And what they did, they legislated, they divided the time of gestation into three trimesters. In each trimester, since the quality of life is getting a little bit better, required more and more reason for us to kill you. And it wasn't until you were born that you got your rights. My friend, what in the name of God does birth have to do with your right to life? Nothing. You're either human or you're not human. Birth does not make you human. You are human from the first moment of your existence. How do we know that? Oh my God, in 2001, did they not tell us in that massive genome project that original cell, the zygote, where the two cells fuse, it contains, beneath the 46 chromosomes, 60,000 genes And if you were to print out the chemical information in that original cell, it would take you 800,000 pages. The whole blueprint for your life is there from the very beginning. And just recently you saw, probably in the papers, that they saw the dark matter in between the genes and they thought it was a nothing. Nothing. It's all the switches of the trains, all the trains running, you know, in the subways. And if you don't have the switches going right, they crack up. Well, that dark matter contains incredible information of telling the genes what to do. Now they know it's like 15 trillion computer days of information in between the genes with that dark matter. It's not the dark matter at all. It contains incredible information telling the genes what to do, and they can cure cancer now by going after that dark matter. It's no longer dark. This is an original cell. How great God is, how humbling it is when you understand. And you take this incredible, unbelievable, complicated, irreducible cell, and a girl goes into an abortion clinic, and what do they tell her? Oh, it's just a blood clot. It's nothing. And they tell us it's the greatest accomplishment in the history of mankind. That we have now found in that original cell this incredible information that just blows your mind. And a young girl goes into an abortion mill and they say to her, it's just a blood clot. It's a nothing. Because it's not human till it looks like it's a human. What in the name of God are you talking about? You're either human genetically from the first moment of your existence, or you never will be a human being. You don't evolve from a fish to a mammal. No, that's nonsense. Modern molecular biology, that's nonsense. You are genetically human from the first moment of your existence, or you never will be. How great is God? Every single human being brought into existence, this incredible information, that it's like a whole universe in that original cell. What a humbling thing. You begin to realize it. What a humbling thing it is. And the more we know about life in the womb from the very beginnings, the irony is this, the less respect we have for it. How could that be? Because of the arrogance of our times. We do not believe in God. We think God is made, became the image of man. What do? We make man in the image of God. See, atheism is not like a boring thing. They feel you are theist and you're the boring life. Because you who believe in God, you wait for God to do this and do that. We don't. We play God. We are God. Man exists for man. Man will resolve everything. Man is the author. Man is the one who will resolve all problems. As not to be limited by religious, ethical values. We'll create this brand new progressive world. So you find people who do not believe in spirit, do not believe in God. They run many organizations in our country, in government too. They're in the laboratories. They're dangerous. They're dangerous. You see, when you look at the universe, and you look at the incredible beauty, the majesty, the intelligence, everything, it's just humbling. But if you get taken up with it, then the universe becomes for you not a mirror reflecting the greatness of God, but it becomes a wall that prevents you from seeing God. And you become enamored with the wall. You become lovers of this universe. And not the creator who created the universe. And you're dangerous. Because you then begin to play God. You're going to make everything evolve in a more perfect way. This evolutionary type mentality where everything's evolving for the better, for the better, for the better, with the elimination of the weak are past and destroyed, the strong survive, and progress is made. And so we take that mentality into the laboratories and we say, we will seek out all the imperfect lives and destroy them. And we'll have a better race for tomorrow. We will play God. Whereas Almighty God wants human life. You see, you don't measure a life by its physical qualities. You measure a life because it's precious, it's infinite value. It belongs to God, and Jesus died for this life. And God intends human life to come into existence out of the context of human love in the context of family. And you don't pass a test. You are loved for your sake. You don't have to prove anything. And the ones who seem to be most dependent upon us, they bring out the best in us. The ones who are the weakest, the Down syndrome children, the ones who are the frailest, they bring out patience and love and perseverance and commitment and generosity from us. And all the us, the rest could be, they spoil us rotten. Don't get in the way of my lifestyle. Don't get in the way of my, what I want to do. And so what God sent us, the gift to perfect us, to make us beautiful human beings with compassion and love and understanding for each other. We eliminate all those. That's a mistake. Mistake. No human being is a mistake. Everyone's precious to God. That's the reality of it. And so we live in a society which is godless. We live in a society that's lost a sense of God. A lost a sense of the uniqueness and value of every human life is precious. We live in a society in which we are afraid to assert that marriage between a man and a woman and the context of marriage is where society's foundation stone is and without which no society can stand. And you're not a homophobic. You're not anti-choice. You're not imposing. No, you are an intelligent, rational human being and a Christian. You say, no, you cannot have a society that refuses to have a God, the Father, and to have a united family of nations. A family of nations without a fatherhood? Are you insane? A disrespect for an individual because they're not meeting your standards, as opposed to everyone is special and unique because they meet God's standards? You have to remember this. I said to you, would you die for someone else? Maybe for a friend, that'd be even tough too. Would you die for an enemy? I don't know. That would be someone would slap your face, spit in you, kill you. Would you die for such a person? Jesus did. Jesus did. Isn't that amazing? Amazing. When the world itself was at odds with God, we had been abandoned, we're broken, enemies of God. Instead of abandoning us, the Word took flesh and He came into our midst and He loves us unconditionally. And He died for us while we were sinners. And sometimes a woman, after an abortion, she'll say to me, Father, could God ever love me again? After what I just did. I say, Mom, wrong question. God never stopped loving you. In fact, He never stopped loving you. It's we who stop loving God. The question is not, will God love you again? How can you convince God to love you again? What do you have to say? Nothing, Mom. God never stopped loving you. The question God has for you is, will you love me again? Will you love me again? That's the fact. What does it take to love God again? Well, Mom, maybe a lot of changes have to be done. But let's begin. Let's begin. You are called to go tomorrow to Calvary, to Golgotha. You are called to go where it's midnight and midday. You're called to go to not Operation Wall Street. You're called to go where the real injustice is, born versus the unborn. And you're called to go there not shouting, not screaming, not taking drugs, not nothing. You're called to go there as people of prayer and of mercy and of love. And you're called to go tomorrow to make present this unconditional, everlasting love of God to a world that's forgotten. to a world that's in hopelessness, to a world that's lost the sense of their own worth and their own dignity and their own value. You're called to go there for the mother who's going to have the abortion, for the father who's dragging her there, for the parents who are dragging her there. You're called for the staff that works there, the people who, because Jesus loves them. He does. Amazing. He died for them. He made up excuses for them. Father, he said, forgive them. They know not what they do. And you go there also for the unborn children. Yes, we do. Sometimes we think of Jesus as dying on the cross, alone and abandoned. We have images of that by artists. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Psalm 22, 23. But that is not the truth. That's the psalm, begins that way, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But the reality is that it ends in hope. It does. Our Lord prayed the psalms all his life. And so the cross was normal for him to pray Psalm 22. But Jesus did not die alone and abandoned. He looked down from the cross, and what did he see? He was surrounded by compassion of the women, of John, of his mother. He was surrounded by prayer. He was surrounded by love. And the unborn children should, even though their time is short here on earth, they should not die alone and abandoned with no one praying with for them, having compassion, suffering with them, and loving them, recognizing their existence. What has happened? We treat them as nothing. There's no record kept of their lives. When I was in Dachau, at least the 242,000 people that died there, there was a record kept of their lives. The place where I just, thanks be to God, is closed. No records. You're just a blood clot. No births. But you bring to light by your presence the reality of the victim, the reality of God is precious. This is where you go tomorrow, I call it the Achilles heel of the whole pro-abort industry. You will never win this battle even in churches, in the halls of Congress, in the schools of education, academia. You will not win this battle for life. You must go to where it is their weakest point. When the mother of Achilles held him in the river Styx and the water went over his body and he became invulnerable, she forgot, or he didn't realize. It did not touch his heel where she was holding him. That was his weak spot. And when Paris shot the arrow wrongly and hit him in the heel, he bled to death. The Achilles heel of the whole pro-abortion industry is where you go tomorrow. They say medical services, a medical clinic. My friends, what has medicine got to do with two people walking into a building where both are healthy? Where two come out, one dead and the other wounded. What in the name of God has that got to do with medicine? Nothing. And when you see the people coming out after they have the abortion, with their self-esteem gone through the ground, and realizing, as you know, when Jesus was dying on the cross, the two thieves, Matthew tells us, whose feast day is today, Matthew tells us both of them cursed Jesus, both of them. We're told in Luke, by the end, one thief was watching Mary and John listen to Jesus say, forgive them. He knew he was a king. He asked to have a share of the kingdom. The centurion, the soldier, it wasn't until actually Jesus died that Matthew tells us, after he died, the king, the centurion, put the lance into the side of Jesus. He said, truly this was the Son of God. My God, what have we done? So many women will come tomorrow here and all over the country, around the world, brainwashed into believing this is the answer, it's the answer, it will bring back yesterday, everything be good, all my life again, good, all my life again. Just do it, do it, do it. And they do it. And the first reaction is, oh, thanks be God, my womb is empty, I can get on with my life again. And suddenly, my God, my womb is empty. And the head and the heart gets filled up with pain and suffering. And the self-esteem goes down to the ground. And they say to you, good God, ever love me again? And you say, do you not see us here praying for you? Do you not know we are called by God to make present the unconditional, everlasting love of God to the world that desperately needs it? Do you not understand that it's not two sides, pro-life and anti-life? The living Christ continues his work today to his body, the church, through you. And he wants to continue the work of the Father. He wants the salvation of the souls of these people. But he only can achieve it through people who are making present the unconditional, everlasting love of God in their presence and in their life and in what they do. And so we remove from the sight all anger, all judgment, all protesting, all screaming, all goes. We go to deep prayer, compassion and love. Only those would speak to the people who are well-versed in how to counsel. And once they experience this incredible love, this presence, that after a while, they say, what makes you do this? And you can tell them about Jesus. And now if you receive the Eucharist, you can do this too. So we continue to do the work of Jesus, or Jesus will go out to Akron tomorrow in you, the members of his body. And Jesus goes out of love. We must make that love present. Clear. So tomorrow we'll have Mass here at 8 o'clock. I invite you to come. Do not be afraid to go with me to Calvary. Okay? I've come back from all over the world, so it's not too bad. It's pretty safe. It's really safe. I can do it in New York City. You can do it anywhere, you know. But what we'll do is, we're rather simple. We will begin with the Mass. At the end of the Mass, we expose the Blessed Sacrament. We expose the Blessed Sacrament, leave a few people here in prayer from the Blessed up till we return. Then everybody simply takes with them a song sheet. We begin the rosary from the Blessed Sacrament here. And then we'll go to the cars. What we'll do tomorrow is we go to the cars, we can carpool. There'll be a direction of where we're going to go from here, the church, to where we're going to park, and then we're going to go to walk to the abortion clinic. When you go in the cars, there's someone in the car to lead Hail Marys, very lowly but clearly, just maintain prayer. When you get to the site, you park your car, get out of it in silence. And then we line up, we'll say in 43rd and 3rd Street. We line up in twos. And then we'll distribute to you a song sheet. I have walkie-talkies. I will have walkie-talkies spread through the crowd. I will say the first part of the prayer or the rosary, and you respond. And then we're going to go in song and prayer to the site. And when we arrive there, we'll say the joyful mysteries on the way, and then we're going to say the sorrowful and glorious mysteries at the site. And then, before returning in prayer to the cause, we have what we do all over the world. For 1 minute, in absolute silence, I'm going to ask you either genuflecting, kneeling, or standing. Simply repeat, mercy, 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 over and again in your hearts. It's very powerful. It's done all over the world. Suddenly, here are these people right in the middle of Times Square, all over the world, kneeling publicly. We bring God. So we can't have God in the schools. We can't have God in the Congress. We can't have God in the courts. We'll bring God to the public square. You can't stop us. You can't stop us. We have a right to be there as citizens, but then we'll be there as Christians. And we're going to go where? We're going to go to Calvary. See, all of this rotten culture of death finds its ultimate effects and consequences where you go tomorrow, where the babies die, the mothers are exploited, population control, people have their field day, marriage is destroyed, chastity is destroyed, everything. We're going to turn that place into a place of healing, a place of love. If there are people who are sidewalk counselors, they're the only ones who talk to the women. We give them a wide berth. We probably, but I don't know what the situation, we'll probably be on across the street and some on one side. The less on one side, most across the street. So people going, they can see prayer on both sides. They don't say, we're not going to move everybody's back to the traffic. We're going to put most across the street praying across, and then some on the other side. And while we're praying, if there's some people offering help, that's the ideal thing to do. The ideal thing to do. But in an atmosphere of pure prayer. And then when we finish the 1 minute of absolute silence, we rise up, and we sing the final hymns in prayer, and then in prayer, we make our way back to the cars, doing the luminous mysteries, singing the Lord's hymn, Immaculate Mary, between the verses. And then we drive back in silence to the church for closing benediction. And that's the end of the vigil. It's a tremendous public witness. It is a very holy thing to do. It changes everything. And then following the vigil, after getting a little break for some sandwiches, something like that, I don't know what it'd be, but we'll have a workshop. But what do you do after the prayer vigil? How do you follow that up? We'll explain what we do around the world. Okay, that'd be the next step. So I invite you to, don't let me go alone. I'm a coward. Someone come with me tomorrow. Okay. I'm tired of going alone to Calvary. You know, Jesus, you say, where are the priests? You've got to remember, the first Calvary, 11 of us cut out. We're just trying to keep the record going, you know. The only difference is when we cut out, you know it. When late people cut out, no one notices it. See, when we're cowards, everybody recognizes it. But when you're cowards, you get away with it. But let's be heroes tomorrow, together. Okay, let's be a Calvary. Begin. And when we do, God will multiply our efforts. Okay, God will bring about a victory for life. And so that you end up not having any hate in your heart at all. You're going to really grow as Christians. Now, this last thing I simply say is this. God came into the world and he asked Mary permission. She said yes. The Word took flesh in her womb. And then he said to Mary, give me to the world. She did. At Calvary. She knew her son was a priest. He became a priest at the moment of conception in her womb. He joined divinity and humanity. And so she knew what Jesus was doing. Was he's out offering his priestly work at Calvary. Tomorrow, God says to you, God, I'm asking for permission. I'd like to come and live within you. It's called Holy Communion. And then he said, now, I want to go to Calvary in Akron. But I need you. Will you bring me there like Mary? Mary will show us where it is. She'll lead the way. She'll bring us. So we go with Mary and Jesus and all the angels and saints of God. It's one of the best places to be. What was the greatest evil that ever took place on the face of the earth? The day we killed our God. Cool. First Friday. What was the greatest good that ever took place? The day our God was killed. Called the redemption of the world. Simple. We turn the place of death, the culture of death with its weakness and all of its implications, into the place of victory and a place of joy. Okay? And we end up fulfilling the final commandment Jesus gave to us, which is what? Love your enemies and change the world. Tomorrow we'll change the world. And God will give us the strength to do so. God bless you. Thank you.